House Civil Law Committee will come to order. Chair recognizes a quorum. Representative Holberg, are you ready to go on 2795?
I am, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And for the purposes of getting started, Representative Holberg moves that House File 2795 be referred to Transportation Policy. And there is an author's amendment, A14 amendment. In order to get the bill in the shape, the author desires, all in favor of the A14 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. So to your bill as amended, Representative Holberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This bill tries to resolve a problem with the bulk purchase of records from the Department of Public Safety that's permitted by federal law. Unfortunately, the groups that are affected by this issue have been trying to work with the department. Last fall, the department sent out a letter that said they no longer allow for bulk purchase and would require that purchase required on an individual basis at $5 per transaction. As far as we can tell, that we would be the only state in the country that would revert to this type of procedure. There's been a number of meetings, letters from the Auto Dealers Association, I understand, that haven't even been responded to. This is out of a sense of frustration in trying to work out this issue just with the insurance industry. They calculate that the additional cost to the industry would be about $7 million a year. Now, some may ask why somebody who has a reputation of trying to guard information and privacy, et cetera, might be carrying this legislation. And all of these uses are permitted by federal law. There was a quite extensive process in the mid-90s. Some of the people in this room were involved in when the federal government set forth the standards for this data and the permitted uses. The state enacted their policy that affirmed or allowed these uses in the state of Minnesota. One of my frustrations is that in government, when we spend taxpayers' dollars to build information systems or put amenities in place, then there seems to be kind of a proprietary attitude about it, and that it should only serve government functions. And if we are able to provide information in a cost-effective manner that is allowed to be shared, I see no reason why we should put policies in place that impose unreasonable fees for access to information held in systems that the taxpayers paid for. And I think I'd like to start with Mr. Anfinson, who can provide a little bit of background on the process. There's a number of testifiers today here on the issue. In the interest of time, I think I'd like to go through the testifiers and then fill in any holes at the end.
Sure. Mr. Anfinson, if you can come forward and introduce yourself for the record.
All right, well,
your next testifier.
Okay, now I'm out on the lifeboat here. I'll take any phone a friend at this point, I guess.
Welcome. Well, I thought you'd be your phone a friend. Good morning, everyone. Chairman Lash, Ranking Member Scott, committee members and staff, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today in support of House File 2795. My name is Michelle Engdahl, and I'm the Director of Government Affairs at Thomson Reuters. We have deep roots in Minnesota. We go back to 1872. You may remember a company called West Publishing. That is now Thomson Reuters. We currently employ over 7,000 professionals in Eagan. And we make products in Eagan that are dependent on this bulk data. So Thomson Reuters accesses motor vehicle title and registration records and driver's license data throughout the United States. The use of this data is governed by federal law, state statute, and legal agreements with state offices such as Minnesota Driver and Vehicle Services. Access to bulk files allows us to provide our customers, which include law enforcement, fraud investigators, lawyers, and legal researchers, with effective and efficient investigative and research products. We are here today because the Minnesota Driver and Vehicle Services Division of the Department of Public Safety has made an administrative decision to cut off bulk access to companies like Thomson Reuters and others you will hear from today. Continued access to bulk data is critical due to the size of the files and our customers' need for immediate record availability. Individual record lookup is not a viable alternative to our business model. Interrelated data between individuals and property is a critical component that is achieved when our systems look at large amounts of data. Often the investigators using Thomson Reuters products do not know many details about their research subjects because the subjects themselves are trying to be anonymous or not found, and they may be avoiding detection and may be hiding assets. In these situations, the Minnesota Department of Public Safety and Driver and Vehicle Services solution of searching their system with individual lookups using a person's name or a vehicle's VIN will not be possible. Integration of the Department of Public Safety bulk file with Thomson Reuters research products is the most effective way to provide law enforcement, fraud investigators, and legal researchers with enough search flexibility to efficiently do their jobs. I'm joined today by my colleague, Paul Wolitz, a product development director at Thomson Reuters, who is available to answer questions. In closing, I urge you to support House File 2795, and I'm happy to stand for questions.
Thank you, Ms. Engdahl. Questions for members? Ms. Engdahl, so you could, if you wanted to, look these individual citizens' information up individually, right? But you said that it's just, as I understand it, it's just not profitable for you to do it that way. Is that, am I understanding that correctly?
I would say that it's not efficient. And many times we hear from our customers that they know some of the data. They might know a partial license plate and the color of the car. They may hear that from a witness. Well, they can use our system to type in what they know, and it starts to feed them information. So the idea that we would have the full piece of information, then yes, we could go in and do an individual lookup. But that's typically what we hear from our customers and our users, that they don't have that luxury of having the complete picture.
Okay. Well, and the reason I ask is because the bulk data issue kind of implicates some of what we did on LPR last session, there was a pretty strong stance in the House about it. If you're looking up a partial plate, that means you're necessarily examining the information and plates of a bunch of other individuals who couldn't be your suspected person, right? And those people are getting queried as well?
Yes.
Okay. All right, thank you. Any other questions from members? Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Engdahl.
Thank you.
And I see Mr. Amphinson is here now. Mr. Amphinson, are you ready?
As ready as I'll ever be.
All right.
Good morning. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members. I'd like the record to reflect that I had a flat tire in St. Paul on my way over here, and it complicated my schedule. So
it will so reflect. Is anyone in the room who can go get Mr. Amphinson's car? Please.
I thought once the ice melted, that would be a minor issue. But what do I know? So. As members of the committee know, I've represented the Minnesota Newspaper Association for many years, and in the course of time, I've also represented most of the news organizations in the state. And a few have been users of the bulk data obtained from these two big databases from the Department of Public Safety. Now, the author has asked me to give a quick, brief background about this law, and I will do, that's correct, is it not? And I will do that. And again, I apologize to the committee for being late. What we're talking about, if I were to draw a picture of what this bill does, instead of talking about it, I would draw a picture of a large pause button, because all the bill would do is hit the pause button in terms of what the Department of Public Safety has proposed in terms of a change in its policy with bulk data access. And we're talking about two large databases. We're talking about the database that holds driver's license data on Minnesotans, and we're talking about the database that holds motor vehicle registration data. They're pretty big, and they have lots of important data. And in the 1990s, Congress passed a law called the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, which mostly classified all of that data as private, not routinely accessible. It is worth remembering, though, that prior to the 1990s, when the DPPA, the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, was enacted, these two databases were public in Minnesota. They'd been public since the beginning of the state. Any member of the public could get access to driver's license and motor vehicle registration data. So that had been the historical background. Now, in passing the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, Congress did recognize, for very compelling reasons, that while general public access should be cut off, there were some uses of this data that were publicly very valuable. In fact, critical in some cases. And you're going to hear about those from some of the other witnesses. So Congress carved out in the law what they call permissible uses of this now private data. And they said to the states, Minnesota, Ohio, Florida, if you want to allow access for these permissible uses in your states, you have the option to do that. They created a state option. Minnesota quickly was one of the first states around 2000 that embraced that option and passed, amended two of its statutes to say that for the permissible uses under federal law, access was permitted in Minnesota. Okay? Now, what's critical to understand here that for some of these permissible uses, where limited users are allowed access to the databases still, you have to have bulk access. Individual lookups simply don't work for things like motor vehicle safety recalls, which often involve at least 100,000 vehicles, and sometimes many more. So you need bulk access. Individual lookups don't work. Since about 2000, when Minnesota embraced the federal option of allowing access to permissible uses, the Department of Public Safety has always allowed bulk access. Many of the users who are in the room today, represented in the room today, who will speak on this, and news organizations have been allowed bulk access to the data. Now, when the department announced last fall that its policy was going to change, it was no longer going to permit bulk access, that was noticed. And many of these groups, including my news organization clients, contacted the department and first tried to achieve some understanding as to why this was necessary. What was the goal? What was the problem? And secondly, to persuade them that if they did this too quickly, too precipitously, they were going to cause serious consequences for Minnesota consumers and Minnesota residents. And we've had many cordial conversations with the department, but they have delayed the effective date of the bulk data policy change to May 12th, but they have not, just about the time the legislature may be done. But they have not changed their view that bulk data access, as it's traditionally been allowed, will be cut off. So the news organizations I represent and the many other groups represented here who have an interest in this bill come before you now because we have no other options. Because if some kind of legislation is not enacted, it looks like bulk data access will be lost. And again, I'm not going to belabor the consequences. Others will do that more eloquently than I can. But it's going to cause potentially severe negative consequences for many, many Minnesotans. And again, the strange thing as I sit here for me is we've never been given a really clear reason why this is critical or necessary or required. So basically the bill would say to the department. You can't change your bulk policies now in May. Over the interim, you have to the Department of Public Safety with the Department of Administration, where the state has housed its data policy expertise. Those two departments would conduct a study on what are complex issues surrounding bulk data access. A report would be submitted to you by January 15th, and the issue could be taken up again more carefully, more comprehensively, more intelligently. And so that's what the bill does. Again, just in terms of my clients, news organizations, what do news organizations use bulk data access for? They have used it historically many times. Not only the big news organizations do this, by the way, but they're important. The Star Tribune, KSTP-TV, Minnesota Public Radio, the Pioneer Press. What do they use this for? They use these databases privately to do database analysis of important issues. One quick example. A few years ago, the Pioneer Press did a study using these databases, which correlated school bus drivers working for the public schools with folks who had impaired driving charges and convictions. And from that study, can reach some useful conclusions, not for the Pioneer Press, but for the Minnesota residents. And you can only do that kind of study if you have access to the full database and can process it and analyze it and compare the millions of names that it contains. So I'll stop there, and if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Hamilton. Questions from members? Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, question I have, you'd mentioned that automobile manufacturers also use this data, and I take that in case there's a safety recall required by the federal government. Without this bulk data, my question would be, is there any way that the safety recall notices could be mailed out efficiently and quickly without or to the owners of these vehicles to have these safety issues repaired?
Mr. Amundson.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, there are folks in the room who can answer that question much better than I can, but I have participated in meetings of this ad hoc group, and it's my sense that the answer to your question would clearly be no, and I think that of all the impacts that this change in policy by the department will have, the no-brainer here is the extraordinary impact on the effectiveness of motor vehicle safety recalls. I don't get that one at all.
Questions from members. Mr. Amundson, how many organizations have had access to a Minnesotan's bulk data in the last year? Do you have that answer?
Mr. Chairman, I don't. It's a fairly small number because the uses that are allowed under federal law are very narrow and limited. I think it's a small number. Only the department would know that number for sure. I will say this, though, in terms of supplementing my answer, the federal law, the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, imposes rather nasty civil and criminal liability on private users who get access to this data, like my clients, and who would then have the stupidity to misuse it or disclose it improperly. I mean, and furthermore, the department, when you seek bulk access from the Department of Public Safety, they don't just say, here it is, come on over and pick up the disk. They require you to sign a 4 or 5 page agreement that only a lawyer could love, and then not many lawyers, because it is just full of wicked liability provisions and indemnification requirements back to the state, and a detailed description of what you cannot do with this data, and if you do, the booby hatch opens underneath you for sure. So for that reason, that's
a legal term.
That is a legal term, and I love using legal terms at this committee. I don't think there are many.
I don't have a good sense of what those consequences are and what the limitations are. As far as I'm concerned, if I have a blog, from what I understand so far, if I have a blog and I have enough money, and that's my other question is what does it cost? I could give a check and get it and sign the release, and as long as I didn't cross those parameters, or no one found out I crossed the parameters, I could use it. So what are those parameters set up in federal law?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I don't think you as a blogger could possibly get access under the permissible uses. The federal law spells these out pretty precisely.
And members, if on page 2 and 3 of the bill summary is a pretty good outline of the standards, thanks to Mr. Gehring.
That's correct. There are 14. Some are very obscure. But when you enter into an agreement with the Department of Public Safety Driver and Vehicle Services Division to obtain bulk access, one of the things in that agreement that you must do is certify that you are an authorized recipient of the data for these purposes. And they scrutinize your certification pretty carefully. It's not like they just take your word for it, in my experience, that it's okay. They have to be satisfied, and that's good. I mean, one can only praise and respect the department for that part of its policy. They look at you carefully. They hold up a magnifying glass to you. So I don't think it's a matter that any blogger can get access, and I'd be pretty sure, Mr. Chairman, that that kind of access has never happened since this law took effect.
Well, I see number 12, Mr. Anfinson. It's also permissible for bulk distribution for surveys, marketings, or solicitation if the state has obtained the express consent of the person. Are there any other areas in law where we have given express consent for this kind of thing where we don't know it, that you're aware of?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure what the punchline there of your question.
It's not a rhetorical question. My wondering is you know, when I sign up for something with a company, or I go online and buy something, and I forget to uncheck the box that says, please send me more of your junk mail, that I've expressly then, because I clicked checkout, I've expressly given them permission to send me all this junk mail, and I'm wondering if I fall under that list as well.
Mr. Chairman, no. I mean, 12 is the least used of all the permissible uses, because basically what it says is the Minnesota resident, let's say, Mark Anfinson, who's got driver's license data with the state, must have given his express written consent for that person to contact me. That doesn't happen very often. There was a period of about 4 or 5 years early in the history of the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, back in the late 90s, when it was an opt-out system. Public access continued to these entire databases unless residents opted out. That changed with the Shelby Amendment in the early 2000s. So that is new.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I just wonder. I was just going back to the booby hatch opening up and the statement that only some lawyers could love. I just wondered if the booby hatch has opened for anybody. I think you maybe said no, it hasn't. But I just want to clarify that. Have there been any actions against anybody for violating that agreement?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, not to my knowledge in Minnesota for violations by private companies. However, you're all aware of the other side of the coin here in that there have been a few lawsuits of note against government employees who violated this law. Over at the DNR, there's a notorious case and many police officers. Frankly, so that's the same liability, though. It's the same law. It's the same legal scheme. So in other parts of the country, it has also happened. So that is the booby hatch, and it has opened.
Well, and Mr. Chair, I'd like to add, if that was the issue, the department has failed to communicate that to the users. They've been asking for months, what are the problems? Can we sit down? Can we resolve them? You'll see in further testimony, there's a whole stack also of inserts in your packet from different organizations, and some of them talk about what other states do. I guess the point that I would like to make is that if we as policymakers think that the dissemination is too broad or bulk purchase should not be allowed for specific purposes, that's another discussion, and I would welcome that. what we're talking about is the business model here, and making a business model that makes it impossible for important pieces of how things work in our state to work. And the auto dealers will be here. We're talking about the recalls, issues around Amber Alerts, and how you identify vehicles. There are very good public safety purposes to allow the distribution of this information in a cost-effective and efficient manner. If there is rampant problems with security and abuse of this data in the private sector, like we've definitely seen in the public sector, then we as policymakers should know about that. But to date, nobody has articulated any massive problems with the use as permitted under federal law and state policy.
Thank you. Other questions from Mr. Amundson? If not, we have other testifiers on the list. Amber Backus, Bob Johnson, Dominic Spicetto, and Eric Rosenberg.
Thank you
for your testimony, Mr. Amundson. Backus, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus.
Ms. Backus, if you could keep it brief as well with the number of folks we have on and the number of bills. Thank you.
Yes, I'd be happy to do so. My name is Amber Backus, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Auto Dealers Association, not to speak to the Amber Alert piece of this. But I did want to say we appreciate the time that you're devoting to this issue. As impacted stakeholders, we have not had the opportunity to have direct conversations with the agency about the reasons for doing this and the implications of cutting off access to bulk data, which is very critical to our industry for both public safety and economic competitiveness reasons. Our members do not buy this data in bulk, but we are customers of two of the major companies that do. And we are using it for very important purposes, and you've touched on one of them already, and that's the instance if there are recalls of motor vehicles in the state of Minnesota. Right now, we have a great infrastructure in place and a system that works and a system that gets out notices in an extremely timely manner. The original equipment manufacturers, OEMs, provide the VIN numbers, vehicle identification numbers, to companies like Polk or Experian Auto, who then run them through their database to figure out who owns these vehicles, where they're located, and then that information is provided back to the manufacturers and dealers so we can contact our customers within an extremely timely manner. I think the decision to cut off this access is going to add undue delays and costs to the system. I know in calendar year 2013, there were about 1.8 billion auto recalls across the country. And when those vehicle identification numbers are provided, they're not provided with where those vehicles are located. That's part of the process that these companies provide for our members. So I can't imagine how the Department of Public Safety would be able to process 1.8 billion VIN numbers, and that's all of them across the country, to figure out which ones are in Minnesota, to then get that information back out in a timely way that the impacted dealers and customers could be notified. We definitely also use this information for our business planning. It's the underpinning of what we do. This information is the most comprehensive look at the state, the fleet of vehicles in the state of Minnesota. So we are allowed to receive statistical information without any personal information tied to it from these companies who have access to the bulk data. And we use this to determine our sales levels, our marketing campaigns, focus advertising budgets, manage our inventories, not just the vehicles in the state, but all the parts needed to service those vehicles. Without access to this information, I'm not sure where we could get that. And even the state of Minnesota uses this information in terms of its own planning with regards to policy of alternatively fueled motor vehicles. Just last week, the Legislative Energy Commission was looking at electric vehicles in the state and had a number about how many are registered in Minnesota, and all this information came from one of the suppliers of this data. So again, this is very important to us in terms of the public safety aspect, but also providing us information that's critical to our business functions, and we'd ask that you continue to allow access.
Thank you, Ms. Backus.
Mr. Chair, if I might, in your packets is a February 18th letter from the Auto Dealers Association. I'm just curious if Ms. Backus and their organization has ever received a response to this letter.
Ms. Backus?
Mr. Chair, members, no, we have not yet.
And I think, Mr. Chair, that's particularly troubling when you look at the relationship between the auto dealers and the state of Minnesota and all the things they do for us by title work, collecting sales tax, making sure that the whole system that we have relative to taxing and managing vehicle use and safety in our state. The fact that it's been nearly a month and their letter hasn't even been responded to is an indication of the frustration that some of these people testifying today are feeling over this issue.
Ms. Beck, is 1.8 billion recalls, that's six times as many cars as there are for every man, woman, and child in the United States of America. I don't think there are six cars for every man, woman, and child. Is this multiple recalls for the same car, for different systems in the same car? And if that's the case, why can't you just pull their information once rather than a bunch of times?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not an expert in that part, but I do know there are specific parts within a vehicle that could have issues, and it might not be something that needs to be taken off the road right away, but it is something that needs attention to service, so you need to bring it back so that you don't have worse complications down the road. So could be, and you might not get notice that there's a problem all at the same time is the other issue. So as there are investigations as to how something's working or not working, you might find that out after you've already issued one recall.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions for Ms. Backus? Thank you, Ms. Backus, for your testimony. Next testifier, Bob Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not Bob Johnson. You know Bob Johnson very well. My name is Mark Kulda. That's spelled K-U-L-D-A. I am with the Insurance Federation of Minnesota, like Bob Johnson. With me today is Mr. Dave Sapansky from the Minnesota Independent Insurance Agents and Brokers. We want to give the insurance perspective to this issue. From the insurance industry's perspective, we are, like the auto dealers, not direct purchasers of the bulk data, but we buy this data through the data vendors, and we are one of the biggest users of this data. We use it for three different ways. One is to verify that a person applying for insurance has a valid driver's license. We also use this information from their driving record to underwrite the insurance policies, and that's perhaps the biggest use of this data is to accurately ensure that a person that applies for insurance pays the appropriate premium. And so if we don't have access to this data, this could affect our underwriting. But also, I guess not very well understood, is that we use a certain stream of data that can only be provided in bulk, and that is the insurers get a list of the newly licensed drivers, and they compare it against the households in the insurance company, and we can determine who needs to be signed up for insurance. So the insurance company can notify the parent of the newly licensed driver that they need to be added to the policy, and that can only happen if we have access to the bulk data. We have two real concerns about the Department of Public Safety's proposal. One is the cost, which has been identified. Currently, we buy the access, the data in bulk from the providers, and it usually costs less than a dollar per lookup. The new subscription service is very clear that they're going to charge $5 per lookup, which is a significant increase in expense for insurers. And it's not just necessarily the one lookup. That's just assuming that you're going with your current insurance company. But what if you shop for insurance? It's a smart consumer idea to shop your coverage around. If you have to do lookups for four or five different insurance companies, they're all going to have to pay $5 each. If you go to five different companies, that's now $25 in lookup fees, but only one company, or you're going to buy the coverage from one company. So that those costs are going to be assessed to everybody driving, even if you didn't purchase through that individual company. Most importantly, though, and this is something that also hasn't been brought up, the Department of Public Safety's proposal under the new subscription service, the individual lookups would only be available when the Department of Public Safety is open, so during business hours. So if you wanted to shop for insurance at nights or on weekends, you may not be able to get an insurance policy because your insurance company may not be able to use the database during certain hours. So we're very concerned about the possibility of the prospect of Minnesota being the only state in the country where its citizens can't buy auto insurance at nights or on weekends, and that's a very big concern of ours. I'll let Mr. Dave Sapansky speak about the different ways that independent insurance agents also use this information.
Thank you, sir. Please introduce yourself for the record. Begin your testimony, and please keep it brief.
Yes. My name is David Sapansky, S-Z-C-Z-E-P-A-N-S-K-I. I'm with Gary, and that's spelled a lot simpler than that, Insurance Center in beautiful downtown North St. Paul. I'm part of the Independent Insurance Agents of Minnesota and a former past president of that group. This bill would help us enormously to maintain the types of cost structures that we have in our agencies right now. I queried our group yesterday, and our agency is a relatively small to medium-sized shop. We have 11 people. We quote approximately 30 to 40 different folks every week. And in those, on an average basis, that would mean about 100 motor vehicle records that we would have just for personal insurance. Right now, that costs us about $100 a week. This would cost us about $500 a week under this method. Also, it makes it much more cumbersome to get. Right now, we can access it pretty easily. In the commercial area, in our agency, we're averaging about 30 queries a week. And if we have a situation where we're insuring a trucking company, a bus company, a contractor, when their policies come up for renewal, we have to check their driver lists to find, make sure that all those people still qualify for insurance and advise those insureds of ours whether or not those people are still qualified to be insured under those policies. Under those situations, we're again absorbing costs that start to get quite high, and we would have to pass those on to our clients. Many times our clients will ask us, because it becomes difficult for them to get this, they'll have one of their, let's say, drivers sign a release to allow them to obtain a motor vehicle report, ask us to get it for them, we'll get it for them, and then they'll determine whether or not that person's going to be driving one of their vehicles or not. This goes along with school bus fleets also. So this, the situation as it's becoming now is becoming quite, would become quite cumbersome and expensive for us in our industry.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sapansky. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Sapansky, you just gave me a novel idea while I'm listening to your testimony, and by the way, thanks for coming down. With regard to this insurance, you know, you're talking about shopping for insurance. We might be able to convince some of our representatives here to come up with this this novel idea called MinCar. That we could go online and shop for insurance through our government. Might want to check into that.
Thank you. Any other questions, rhetorical or otherwise? Seeing none, then thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kansky.
Thank you.
Next testifier, Dominic Spicetto. Oh, excellent. Thank you. Okay, so Eric Rosenberg with TransUnion.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. Thank you for addressing this issue. My name is Eric Rosenberg. I'm Director of State Government Relations for TransUnion. TransUnion is a information services provider. We're headquartered in Chicago. We access bulk motor vehicle records in many jurisdictions across the country and provide that to our customers who have a permissible purpose. That's a strict permissible purpose under the DPPA, the Driver's Privacy Protection Act, to access that information to provide their services that are highly regulated under the law. The security and accuracy of the information we manage is key to everything in our business. As such, we have concerns with shutting off access to bulk motor vehicle records in Minnesota and appreciate your attention to further studying this issue. I will reiterate that something to consider is that all the services we provide and our customers provide using data obtained in bulk are highly regulated by DPPA. Specifically, this restricts disclosure of personal information from a motor vehicle record, including for marketing, but specifically permits disclosure where an individual has consented and for ID verification and skip tracing, but not including the SSN, auto recalls, litigation preparation, insurance claims, and underwriting. Bulk access allows us to confirm and verify personally identifying information to detect variances and anomalies arising from misspellings and transpositions of names and addresses, incorrect and fraudulent addresses, and inaccuracies and transpositions associated with dates of births. Leveraged by our vast data repository, our algorithms require bulk access of records to analyze and compare records across states in our highly mobile environment. This allows our customers to prevent fraud with real-time access in a highly regulated environment across the states. On the other hand, transactional access of records done on a single request basis hinders our ability to provide fraud detection and mitigation, due diligence and verification solutions resulting from the limited search and query types currently available from the state's transactional access service. When customers query our databases, we can do it in 40, 50 different types. We can combine different data elements, something that's not currently available when we search directly on a transactional basis through the state. For our customers, it is an extremely costly and improbable proposition to access MVR data and other data sources from disparate states and sources on a transactional basis. With this, I urge the committee to stop the imminent loss of bulk records access and support further studying this issue through the support of this bill. Thanks, and I'm available for any questions.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Rosenberg. Questions from the committee? Seeing none. Thank you. We have representatives of the Department of Public Safety here to testify. And after that, if there are any members of the audience who wish to be heard on this, please come down, sit in the seats behind, and be prepared to proceed. We've got to get moving on this. Please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mary Ellison. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Public Safety. And unfortunately, there's been a lot of misinformation that has been provided. And so we want to just set the record straight. And if after the record is straight and you've thoroughly vetted this bill, you want to pass it, then we, of course, will implement it however it is passed. The Department of Public Safety began selling driver and vehicle services data in bulk. You have to excuse me, I ran from the parking lot here. In the 1990s, long before any of us were here, but and long before there was the level of concern that there is now about data privacy. As Representative Holberg knows, and many members of the committee knows, since then there's been a huge outcry and concern about the privacy of this data. So we looked at the situation. We also received an informal opinion from the Information Analysis Policy Division of the Department of Administration that we were selling this data incorrectly. There's nothing in statute that talks about the sale of bulk data. The only reference to it is that people have to give their permission affirmatively in order for us to provide this data in bulk. But the department started doing it, and they started doing it under Chapter 13, which allowed for the department to charge for the price of producing the data. And again, that was back in the 1990s. That hasn't changed. And of course, since then, there's been a huge outcry about the privacy of data. We get calls continuously from citizens who say, how did XYZ company who's soliciting me for to buy a product get my data? And we have to tell them that we sell it to in bulk to organizations under federal law, but we do not have the ability to audit all those companies and see whether or not they're reselling it for appropriate purposes. Given all that happened with law enforcement, and also several years ago, there was a company called ShadowSoft that was offshore and bought the information from one of the companies that we sold in bulk to, who had an agreement with us that they would not sell it for any other purpose not allowed in federal law. Well, they sold it willy-nilly to everybody. And of course, that created a huge outcry. And so we feel like this change is absolutely appropriate for the citizens of the state to protect their data. It is true that businesses rely on this to conduct their business, and we have allowed a process for them to continue to do that. For them to say that there was no notice is just simply not true. Director McCormick sent a letter to every single company that purchases data from us and informed them of this change. We've conducted countless over-the-phone interviews and information with people at the request of the industry. We delayed implementing it until we could get a subscription service that we felt would meet the needs of protecting people's privacy and also meet their needs. the $5 fee comes from statute. iPad pointed out to us that we really should be charging $5 per record because that's where the legislature put the fee many years ago. So if there's an issue over the fee, the legislature can change that fee. But under the change that we have no other recourse except to charge what the statute says we should be charging. And so to say that recalls won't be provided is simply not true. We have the ability to provide all of the information that's needed to the industry for them to do their recalls. And Director McCormick can explain that process. I'm very disappointed that people have chosen to misrepresent our intentions and misrepresent the facts and create all kinds of fear that insurance rates somehow are going to go up. Please understand that the reason people give us this data is because they want a driver's license and they want to register a title. Citizens are not giving us this data so that industry can resell it and be have people be contacted by people selling products. They just don't like that. And so with the process that we've proposed, we would have the resources to audit them to make sure that they are using the data appropriately, that they're not reselling it for purposes not allowed under federal law. However, we understand that you as legislators can weigh in on this. And if you feel it's in the best interest of your friends and neighbors to have this data continue to be sold in bulk, then I suggest that you pass the bill. And we will do as directed, and if the governor signs the bill, we will implement that. So let me ask Ms. McCormick to talk about the details.
Well, Ellison, as far as your statements, if I had a nickel for every industry that came in saying that citizens' prices would go up if you changed the law pertaining to them, I could pay for new data sets from your department every day. So I don't think anyone on this committee is bamboozled by those kinds of statements. And just statement for the record. Please introduce yourself for the record. Begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And as Commissioner Ellison said, we have been working with the bulk users to be able to address their needs because they said that there are specific things that they really do need a subscription service for. And so that's how we have addressed it right now. And in order to ensure that we're meeting their needs, we have set a date of May 12, 2014, to be able to provide a service that would be a driver's license data subscription service and a vehicle data services subscription service. The process would be that vendors who monitor driver's license data would provide us with a list of those drivers being monitored, and DVS would monitor those records on a daily or weekly basis and provide updates when there are changes to the records. Yes. We would assess a subscription fee for the monitoring of the record as well as the staffing involved in managing the requests and follow-up with each vendor. And the cost would be based on the frequency of the monitoring, whether it's daily, weekly, or monthly. On the vehicle side, DPS and DVS would continue to provide biweekly transaction files with all the public data from vehicle records. This data is in the same format currently received by our customers. The personal information would no longer be available, and that includes the owner's name, the address, except the zip code, and date of birth. Vendors requiring vehicle data would be provided a transaction file, either daily or weekly, of vehicles whose ownership had changed in order to get up-to-date records to be used for the permissible uses that are outlined in our state and federal laws. The costs would be based on the frequency that each vendor would want. In other words, it'd be either daily, weekly, or monthly. A mainframe service would also be able to be available for our bulk data customers. There's three bulk data customers that we have for vehicle data, so that the customers could retrieve vehicle data related to recalls and other permissible uses of vehicle data. The service would accept multiple vehicle identification numbers in one request. DVS would provide a custom job for these recalls. The customer will provide That means our customer would provide the VIN sequence, and then DVS would pull those vehicles from the database so that the data could be received either the same day or the next day to the customer in the same format that our customers now receive it. The cost will be based on the cost to program and provide the necessary information to the recall request. DVS audit would also monitor these data requests. So the pricing for that is, we are still looking at, we're getting very close to being able to notify our vendors of the bulk data for vehicles, especially related to recalls. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to respond to them.
Thank you, Ms. McCormick. Any questions from members? Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As to the comment of these folks, that these companies that resold that data and it was illegally used, how many times has that happened?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, to our knowledge, once. But the problem is that we don't have the ability to audit these. We just don't. So we don't know. The answer to the question is we don't know.
Representative Howe?
So on the one company that you do know, did you prosecute? And if so, what happened to, what was the penalty? And if not, why not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, we did submit it for prosecution, but it was an offshore company, and it was beyond our reach. We were not able to do it, but we discontinued providing the data to that particular company.
Representative Howe.
So did that, was that referred to the federal? Because that would have been a federal, against federal law. So did the federal, was that passed to the federal prosecutors to follow up on then?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, I don't recall. I don't recall. I think that would have been the logical thing, but I don't recall.
I don't, and Representative Howe, the feds don't have jurisdiction offshore, too. It'd have to go Interpol, which is doesn't have any clout there, but question is duly noted. Representative Howe.
But, Mr. Chair, that should have been to the company that resold. That should have been, it was sold to an offshore, but the company that sold it here in the States, the company that bought it here in the States that sold it should have been prosecuted.
That's my Commissioner Ellison, was there anything illegal about that subsequent sale under either our law or federal law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Howe, this is, gets into the tangled difficulty that it is to prove intent. We traced it to a company that we had sold data to. However, we weren't able to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, or, you know, that And we didn't have the resources to pursue this. And that's part of the problem, is that when you sell data and you trust that the companies are auditing, and they perhaps are, but you're not able to trust but verify, it puts us in a very difficult position. And what happened with that case is then Attorney General Hatch held a press conference. It was a Republican administration at the time, and used it as the opportunity to say to the department, you're not protecting this data. Why are you selling this data in bulk, and why are you selling it for pennies on the dollar? Why are you selling it to companies that can repackage it and sell it? And so, again, it's that we don't have the resources to go out and check and verify. And so this was a compromise. And, again, I would say if the legislature feels like this is an appropriate thing, then certainly we would honor and respect that. In some ways, it would make our life easier, because when we get continuous calls from citizens, we can say, well, we proposed an option that we felt was in the best interest of protecting citizens, but the legislature felt differently.
Representative Howe.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just one more. Is there a possibility to limit that data use for within the United States?
Representative Howe, I imagine so, but probably not without raising our insurance rates. Am I correct? No, but I think you're correct, though, Representative Powell. There probably is a way to do it on a federal level, but I'm guessing that that would be the response. Any other questions? Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. McCormick, I just have a concern about resources at the agency. I know in the past, I don't remember if it was following a government shutdown, but the agency got very, very far behind on processing titles, and I think we took some action in the legislature to speed up the title processing. I like the idea of more security over the data, but I'm just not sure that we have the staff in state government to deal with the data in an efficient manner for the insurance industry and the auto industry. If I thought we could turn it around as quickly as they need it, I might consider voting no on this bill, but I'm just concerned about the resources that your agency has, because you've always been very strapped for help, it seems to me.
That was Representative Portman, that was a question for who?
Either Ms. McCormick or the Commissioner.
Okay. Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hartman, we only have one person right now to audit the data, and one of the reasons that when we're looking at the costs associated with the subscription service is to be able to have additional staff that would be able to assist with the auditing. We also believe that the auditing would be much more efficient with the subscription service process that we're talking about. We would be able to much more efficiently audit the use of the data.
Do you
know what the path for this bill is? Is it going to public safety? Is it going to transportation policy or finance?
Representative Portman, the motion is to transportation policy currently.
Okay. Well, I would recommend that there something be done in terms of getting you the resources ahead of time rather than taking this data out of the reach of the private sector and hoping to get enough money to from the new fees to get the job done. I think we need to get you the resources and walk before we run in terms of restricting the data so that you're fully staffed at the time at which you would pull the trigger and make it harder for people to get data, that you actually have the staff to respond to the requests.
Members, we have four other people on the list. We are going on an hour on this bill, and we need to wrap up. I'm open to options from people about how we're going to proceed with this. Representative Anderson, you're next on the list. You're good? Okay, Representative Neuberger.
Thank you. I'll be brief. Commissioner, you're looking at a $5 charge per driver record. Just your best guess. How many records are you looking at per year? How many do you process? How many did you sell in bulk in the last year? Give me just a rough number.
Mr. Chair, Representative, part of the issue is that because we sell it now in bulk and we don't know really what they're doing with the data, we don't know how many records are sold. But we sell it to about six different companies, is it?
12 driver license McCormick. And three vehicle.
And right now they get the whole database whether they need two names, five names, 10 names, or 20 names. So under the new process, they would be only requesting the names that they need. So it's difficult for us to prejudge how many records they will need. And that's part of the issue, because people say we need these records, but if they need my driver's license number for auto insurance purposes, they don't need Pat McCormick's and Representative Holberg's and everybody in this room, but they get all of the data, even though they only need a subset. And so it will be difficult for us to project exactly how many records will be requested.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Who said that? Representative Neuberger.
A follow-up. So when you release the database, just give me a guess. How many names are in the database? How many drivers' names? If my company asks for this database, give me a number.
Commissioner
Allison. Mr. Chair, Representative, there are 7,700,000 motor vehicle records in the DVS database and 6.5 million in the driver's license database.
Representative Berger.
So 6.5 million times roughly $5 a piece. That's a pretty lucrative deal for your department. I just wanted to crunch the numbers quick. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Representative, may I say that the record is set in the price is set in statute, and $2.60 of every purchase goes to the general fund. So if the committee feels that the price is too high, the rate, just change the price.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to ask, do you have any problems with the second part of the bill, Section 3 of the bill, that does is the study piece, or is it just the first part that you're concerned about?
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, it's really a question of resources. We don't have the resources to conduct this expansive of a study right now, but if that's what the legislature directs, then I imagine that we would be asked for a fiscal note, and we could look at the implications of it from a resource perspective.
Representative Liebling.
So thanks, Mr. Chair. So is this intended that this bill would go to finance then?
I mean,
policy, Representative Leibing, policy first, and I'm guessing if a fiscal note is required, then finance.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my question dovetails on Representative Liebling's, and it seems to me like if ever there, and I'm not a big fan of study after study after study, but I feel like in this situation, this is what is the best solution right now, is to figure out how to make this work best for everybody. And I don't think we're going to find that out until there's a study done. So I think it's a good solution to this problem, so that we can reach that good old peace in the valley. So I think it's a great way to solve this problem, because I understand the department's situation, but I understand, you know, the people that are getting this data, that it's important for both sides to for the department to have some control over the data, yet it's important for these other entities to be able to have that to function and to function efficiently. It's not just for their own good, it's for the public's good as well. So I think it's a good bill for the study alone.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, one of the questions I have is, Representative Newberg, we're crunching the numbers. I'm just thinking, how many people apply for insurance every day? Probably across Minnesota, we have how many millions of people, how many millions of drivers? We have over 6 million drivers registered in Minnesota. If just a fraction of them, 100,000 people applied for insurance in one day with the insurance companies, and the insurance companies are going to be checking the insurance agents checking multiple agencies, the department could end up trying to look up 900,000 requests in one day on an individual basis, because when the insurance companies or somebody applies for insurance, the insurance companies can look for their best deal, and each one is going to be sending a request in. I believe it's just going to overload your department, where you're not going to be able to handle it with the current staff setting unless this is in bulk information, where these insurance companies just go to one place and get the information real quickly. It's going to be a nightmare for the insurance companies, and there's no way around it. It's going to raise the rates of the insurance rates across the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. Various members have different ideas about how we could fix this. I'm not normally a fan of laying bills over. I like to move them so that there's pressure to solve the problem immediately rather than waiting. And I'm also not a fan of studies. However, I think we can arrive at some measure of comity on this bill based on the different ideas in the room. So it's the chair's intention to lay this bill over and hear it at another hearing before deadlines, with the hopes that we can come up with some kind of agreement. With that, Representative Liebling.
Oh,
okay.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hobart.
I do have to hit another policy committee, so I have to be able to get into Chair Earhart's committee before the end of next week.
We could potentially add this to Friday afternoon, Representative Holberg.
Oh, look forward to it.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. Chair, as much as I understand the jurisdiction of different committees, I think that really the difficult issues here are public safety issues and issues about the department's staffing and resources, and I'm not sure if this bill pauses somewhere. I think it should be pausing at public safety, or should be pausing at transportation policy or finance. I think in terms of our issues, you know, this committee has the information on what's in the bill with regard to data, and I think we should vote on it today.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, when I first raised my hand, I was going to move to delete the first two sections of the bill, just leaving the study. But because, and now that after that comment from Representative Portman, I think that the jurisdiction of this committee is those first two sections. I mean, certainly the study part could go on and move to transportation, but if the intention is going to be to move the bill, I'm going to move to delete those first two sections at this point. So I don't know what the chair's pleasure is on that, having heard the rest of the discussion. If the chair's going to lay it over to work for further work, I'm fine. I won't make that motion, but you know, I don't know what the chair's intention
is.
Still going
to lay it over. That's
okay.
My current intent.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the question I have is if we lay this bill over with the May 12th deadline coming up, what is the department's plan to handle the staffing that's going to be needed by May 12th?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the way that you described the request for records is not accurate. We intend to proceed with what we have proposed until or unless the legislature directs us and the governor signs a bill that says you will continue to sell this in bulk. Then we have statutory authority to do that. And when people call and complain, we can say, well, the legislature has directed us to continue to sell this in bulk.
Representative Urso.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's a number of different issues wrapped up in this, but in one of the issues that was brought up is the fact that the fee is set in statute at $5. And what would have cost $5 to look up in 1990-something doesn't cost $5 to look up anymore. And I understand that the department as a whole is under-resourced, but the cost of a particular action should reflect, you know, the actual cost for that. So one of the things maybe we need to look at is if it's going to be an individual lookup, does that need to cost $5? Because I don't think it costs $5 for the electrons to go running through the system and find something.
If you want me to comment, I will. I mean, I agree. It's got to be cheaper today than it was in 1990. And the other fact is, for you folks that drive newer vehicles, it's not a big deal. But I drive old vehicles, and I like it when they check if NAPA can figure out that there's a lot of vehicles in my age still on the road, and I can get my part, and it's sitting at the part lot. So don't shortchange that piece of the
deal. Mr.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, and I didn't have the benefit of the full hour of the hearing, but it seems to me we have a bill before us dealing with a question of data privacy brought forward by Representative Holberg. And if you can't trust Representative Holberg on the issues before this committee related to data privacy, I don't think you can trust anybody. So I don't really know what we gain by waiting until Friday as far as the issues before this committee are concerned. I don't know. I would not support taking out those sections of the bill that Representative Liebling is talking about. And if Representative Holberg is satisfied that this is a reasonable set of protections on these issues, I'm perfectly comfortable because I recognize that there are commercial needs for this, and I don't think that we should be in a position in the Civil Law Committee of overly being concerned about whether the department is feeling comfortable selling this or not. That's a jurisdiction for another committee. I think our only purview is looking at it from a citizen's standpoint. And there are balances. You know, you need data to conduct commerce. You can't just sort of shut it down and hope for the best. That's not the world we live in. So I would urge us to just move forward. If you wait till Friday, I don't know what we're going to get that's going to be a lot more helpful as far as this committee is concerned.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
If I might. The testimony here today, if it doesn't support the case for a timeout and try and back up a little bit and have more discussion and figure out how this would move forward, I don't know what else I could do. If the department implements this without our input in the scheme in which they're proposing, there are going to be major issues in the state. Are there other solutions? I think there are. But we are not going to... It took 3 years to pass the bill regulated the data miners. These things take time. This bill basically says continue what you've been doing till the end of the year. In the meantime, everybody get to the table, discuss this range of issues, provide solutions. It may very well be that this body decides that they want to make changes to the standards for bulk purchase and their uses. That may be a result, but that's not going to happen if you just allow them to implement this policy on May 12th. It's not going to change any of our policies, the fee of the $5, the all of these things that have been thrown into the committee discussion this morning could all be vetted through this process, and, you know, there might even be a kumbaya moment sometime, you know, after they work through this process where that they can come to some resolution. But I don't believe this body has enough information today to say whether or not allowing the department to go forward with this proposed subscription service at $5 a piece is going to meet the public safety needs of the state and the other uses for this data.
Thank you, Representative Holberg. Seeing no other comments, Chair lays the bill over. Next bill is Representative Joanne Ward. Thank you for patiently waiting. House File 2405. Chair moves that House File 2405 be referred to the General Register. Representative Ward, to your bill. And we have Rick Hodson here, Assistant Washington County Attorney.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Can I have quiet in the committee room, please? Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Board, Chair and committee. Thank you for hearing House File 2405. I have an author's amendment that I'd like to have put on the bill to put it in shape so that it'll be...
Chair moves the A2 amendment in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Ward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner of Revenue Terry Steenblock is here to answer any questions, and I have Rick Hodson, Assistant Washington County Attorney, to help me in testifying. Mr. Chairman, this is a very simple bill as opposed to the one you just heard. It does what everybody assumes is already true, and that it makes financial account numbers private and non-public. Right now, when you make a check payment to the state or local government, that check, including the financial account number that is on the face of every check, is technically public as long as it remains in the government's possession. Quote, as long as it remains in the government's possession, unquote, is the key. Because under what is called the Check 21, many government entities as well as many businesses no longer physically turn over the checks to their banks when they make a deposit to their accounts. Instead, they send a digital image of the checks to their banks and retain the physical check or its image for whatever is the period specified by their document retention policies. Thus, the physical check and its image is available for a member of the public to request during that retention period. That's what happened to Washington County. A debt collector was aware that a party they were trying to collect from was also a Washington County taxpayer. So the debt collector requested a copy of the check that the party had paid to the county. The county could find nothing in the current data practices law that explicitly made the check non-public or private. So after blanking out the checking account number, they turned over a copy of the check to the debt collector. The county realized that the account number was also technically public, and if released, could easily be used to facilitate accessing the checking account and or for identity theft. Thus, the reason for subdivision one of the bill, making financial account numbers private or non-public. Subdivision two of the bill provides an exception to the current Tennyson warning requirement so that every time an individual makes a payment, the confusing warning does not have to be given simply because the individual is making a payment that incidentally is providing a payer's non-private or non-public financial accounting number. Mr. Chairman, Rick Hodson would like to testify at this point.
Mr. Hodson, please introduce yourself for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Hodson. I am an assistant Washington County attorney, and the representative is outlined the situation quite well. The reality is if anybody in this room has written a check to pay for their dog license, to pay for their driver's license, their real estate taxes, in the olden days, checks would physically go from the paper check, would leave the government and no longer be in our hands and go to the financial institution. Now, under the modern changes, those checks are scanned, that data is preserved. And we have had individuals, and we're now starting to see, as the word gets out, we're seeing a greater increase of people walking in saying, I want a copy of the face of the check, which includes all this information. We worked extensively to try and find some provision of law that would allow us to classify that information as other than public. Because right now, somebody walk in, get all 5,000, and start publishing them on the Internet if they wanted to do that, all that check information. The only thing we could come up with, and we actually wrote and sought the assistance of IPAD, and they agreed with our analysis that under some circumstances we could declare that information to be security data. But they also pointed out that requires local government and state government to literally, every time a request is made, make an individualized check-by-check consideration before we can make, in other words, we can't make a blanket classification under current law and call this information security data. So our remedy that we drafted was to declare that information to be private or non-public data. If people knew that everything that they wrote on a check could be published in the newspapers on the Internet, I think they'd be quite surprised, and we're trying to fix that. The problem is if we do that from a cost standpoint and a burden standpoint, once we collect private data, the presumption is we have to provide a Tennyson warning. And so we are attempting to deal with that issue as well, and that's what Subdivision 2 of the bill tries to do. Bottom line of the bill is it would allow people to write a check to local government and to state government to pay their financial obligations without having their account information, their driver's license number, because that appears on checks as well. It's an interesting discussion you just had. Home addresses, home telephone numbers. Right now, all that's public information. We want to provide some privacy protection to the public, and that was the purpose of the bill.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Hodson. Any questions from members? Members, I think there's a lot of support on this bill as multiple bipartisan authors.
Mr. Chair, I've removed my name from this bill, and I will be voting no. The removal of the Tennyson warning is really problematic, and unfortunately, when Mr. Carlson asked me to sign on the bill, he didn't. We were in the hallway, and I didn't actually look at the language, and so when I realized what he was doing in the Section 2 of the bill, I took my name off.
Noted for the record. Thank you, Representative Holberg. Any other questions or comments from members? Is there anyone from the audience that wishes to be heard on House File 2405 as amended? Mr. Gemmerling, why don't you come up and introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Don Gemmerling. As some of you know, I used to run IPAD. Some of you know I've been working with these issues since 1973. One of the reasons I still come here, and I come here as a volunteer, is the ongoing criticism of the Data Practices Act. Among the ongoing criticisms are it's too big. Okay? And if you look at the statute, it's over 100 pages, so it is in some ways too big. But every once in a while I see a piece of legislation that I think is just absolutely unnecessary, with all due respect to Senator Ward. Security information is a term you came up with, the legislature came up with a number of years ago, to cover a whole wide range of situations where it's appropriate for the government to say certain information infringes on a security interest. The whole idea was to not have to revisit those security issues over and over and over. Okay? Clearly, in the minds of some of us, this kind of information is security information. Why do we try and protect our financial account numbers? So that nobody can break into the security of those numbers. You know, there are all kinds of ways to handle these issues. One of the ways to handle these issues is to get an opinion from IPAD that says these kinds of numbers are security information, and then widely publicize that to state, local, and government. Okay? Go to the county and say, look what IPAD did. And every county in the state, every city in the state, every school district in the state can rely on an IPAD opinion in denying access to that data. That's part of why you wrote the opinion statute. So, Richard is just giving me an opinion from IPAD, and you know, I don't always have to agree with their opinions, frankly. Okay? So, number one, I think these data are already classified. There's already treatment for it in the statute. Do you want to add a few more lines to the Data Practices Act? The lawyers will love it, and we can keep saying the Data Practices Act is too long. Okay? Now, the more important issue is the tennis warning. Okay? You've heard that if I write a check to the government, I have to get a Tennyson warning. What triggers the giving of a Tennyson warning in the Data Practices Act is the government asks an individual to supply private data about him or herself. Okay? Why is that provision there? Back in the 70s, when you were having a privacy discussion, what you focused on was, how do I as an individual protect my privacy from the government? Okay? And you looked at all kinds of ways of dealing with that, but what you decided was you're going to put the onus on the individual to determine whether or not in certain situations they want to give data to the government. And so the Tennyson warning says I get to know how those data are going to be used, who else will have access to them, other things about whether or not I have to legally provide it, and so on. And then I get to decide whether or not I want to let the government have my personal information. Okay? Sounds like the American way to me of doing things. Individual responsibility. Okay? So, what this says is, if they ask me, and that's the key, if they ask me for my financial account number, not if I voluntarily supply it. That was part of the compromise you reached. If I voluntarily supply it, I don't get a Tennyson warning. But if they ask me for it, I have to get a Tennyson warning. Now, this is going to branch out, okay? The reference here is to financial account numbers. Increasingly, we're asked to pay our bills with the government with credit card numbers. Is that a financial account number? So you'll be here next year dealing with that if you continue on this path. So, if there's anything, well, I'll take that back. If there's most anything that I want to know about what the government is going to do with my personal information, it's my financial account numbers. Okay? I would like to know, for example, if I give my financial account number under the Revenue Recapture Act, they can come and get money from me if I owe child support obligations, and I'm too old for that, or if I owe some kind of tax obligation. That might be something I want to know before I am asked to provide them with a check. So, lurking in here is an issue of whether or not saying to somebody, you can pay for that with a check, triggers the Tennyson warning. And frankly, I'm not sure about the answer to that. What I am sure about is the statute is very clear that you only have to get a Tennyson warning if the government asks you to supply information that's classified as private. Period. So I don't know why you would want to take away my ability to protect my privacy by saying you don't have to get individuals Tennyson warning. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kamerling. Representative Ward, as you can see, there is no bill that comes through this committee that is simple, ever. Representative Urso.
No, I took my name.
Okay. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Kamerling, then, would your solution to this bill issue then be just to say that this information is classified as security information, and then we don't need the Tennyson warning? And right, that's what you're saying. If it's classified as security, then the Tennyson warning is not necessary.
Mr. Kamerling.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, it would be necessary if the government
says...
The
government's asking you. Okay.
I want you to give me your financial account numbers, okay? And the rest of the Tennyson warning would then apply.
Okay.
So I think part of the solution is... You could cross-reference to the security information section and say financial account information are security information within the meaning of Section 1337. And that's the section, by the way. That's where security information is.
Thank you.
It adds less language to this statute that everybody complains about the size. So,
Representative Ward, what is the status of this bill in the Senate?
It hasn't been scheduled yet.
Okay. Well, that may be an opportunity to work out some of these details. Some of this is an ideological divide based upon the Tennyson warning itself. Maybe it's bridgeable. I don't know. Are there any other questions from members?
Mm-hmm.
Representative Holberg.
Mr. Chair, are you doing a data practices omnibus bill, or what's your intent here?
It is it is my intent to do an omnibus bill, yes, Representative Holberg. Representative Portman.
Mr. Chair, I just this seems like one that we should lay over and work on, because I think we should clarify 1337, the security information section, and not be dealing with getting rid of the Tennyson warning in this situation. This seems like something we could do in a more streamlined way than what's drafted in the bill.
Any other comments on that point? Testifier wants to weigh in on that?
Yes, please.
Go ahead, and be mindful of the fact we're 4 minutes over on our committee time right now. Mr. Hodson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just so it's clear, when I said we moved all sorts of rocks, we did seek an opinion, an iPad advisory opinion, and when I state right now by calling it security data under existing law, and I don't disagree you could amend the current law, but under existing law, the iPad opinion was we have to make an individualized determination on each and every single check anytime a request is made. And that's an opinion issued, a letter issued January 11th, 2014. So we did try and get that to do what Mr. Gimberling suggests, and it didn't work out for us. That's why we're here.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Any other comments from members? Then, Mr. Gimberling, we're going to play ping pong on this. It is the intention of the author to lay this bill over for consideration of that. Chair lays the bill over.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee.
Members, we are in recess until 7 o'clock tonight, when we will take up the remaining bills.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Holberg.
I will not be able to return this evening due to a family commitment, so the House File 2120 won't be heard this evening.
Civil law, which had been recessed, is back in session. It's 7:03 p.m. and the only remaining bill on the agenda is House File 2576, Representative Moline. But before we do that, I need a motion to approve minutes for March 11th, 2014.
So moved, Representative Chair.
Rosenthal moves those minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you. Representative Moline, you have two author's amendments.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and I'll only be offering the A6 amendment.
Okay. Then, in order to get the bill in, we'll have you explain it afterwards, Representative Moline, but in order to get the bill in the shape the author desires, all in favor of the A6 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. To your bill as amended, Representative Moline, why don't you explain first what we did with A6.
Mr. Chair, that was the incorrect amendment.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Simon moves to reconsider the vote on the A6 amendment. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. So which you want, the A14-0855 author's amendment, Representative Moline?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Now, what did that amendment do, Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair, that just clarified some language that regards the employer liability in these expungement cases. Just needed to add that language. We had forgotten to do so in judiciary.
Okay. Okay, to your bill as amended, Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this bill came out of a joint working bipartisan group, a joint committee between the House and the Senate. We met several times over the interim to address the issue of collateral consequences and expungements. And we know from a number of years that this has been kicked around the legislature, and we've needed to take action as far as collateral consequences go. And recently there were some Minnesota Supreme Court decisions. times and have met with all the interested parties several times, and I think that we still have some work that needs to be done, but we've made progress as far as this bill goes moving forward with changing some of our expungement laws. And I have Mr. Hazy here to go through the sections of the bill.
Great. Mr. Hazy, go ahead.
Thank you,
Thank
you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Mark Hazy. I'm Vice President of the Council on Crime and Justice. I think you've all heard and probably understand some of the reasons for this kind of legislation. I assume that many of you hear from constituents and know people who have some kind of a record. And under current Minnesota law, especially with the recent Supreme Court cases, somebody has any kind of a conviction record, and sometimes even non-conviction records, those last indefinitely and will hold them back from any types of opportunities indefinitely. So with that, I'll go into the section, into the walkthrough of the bill. Section 1 applies to juvenile delinquency records, and the Supreme Court case that was issued this spring said that under the juvenile expungement statute, courts can seal executive branch records. However, they narrowly read the statute to apply only to the record of adjudication. And there are other records, such as the record of the petition and arrest records, that still can hold juveniles back. So what this section does is it clarifies that a judge, considering certain standards that are added here, could seal all the records of a juvenile delinquency matter at the executive as well as the judicial branch. It also allows for those records to be shared between criminal justice agencies as allowed in Section 7 of the bill for adult records. Section 2 allows, Section 2 requires business screening services, those companies that collect government data and sell it back to employers and landlords, to remove a record from their database once it's been expunged. And this is an effort to address that issue that you sometimes hear that if you expunge a record, it's still out there. If the employer landlord is using a reputable background screening service, then this would once somebody had a record expunged, it would not appear there anymore. Section 3 relates to expungement of some eviction records. This is not my area of expertise. I know that this is an area that legal aid works on quite a bit. My understanding of it is that it allows a judge to seal an eviction record at the time a case is dismissed, so that the person does not have to come back into court under certain circumstances to have a record seal if it's just if an unlawful detainer record is just dismissed. Section 4 is a major substantive part of the bill. And what this does is, under current statute, the legislature has already said that certain records can be expunged, and that by virtue of the legislature giving the court that authority means that they can seal the executive branch as well as the judicial branch records. Under current law, only three types of records can be expunged or sealed. Those are cases that were resolved in someone's favor, which means they were not convicted and they did not admit to the facts of the case on the record, which can happen in stays of adjudication and even diversion programs in some counties. That's one area of that it allows for expungement. Another area is some drug crimes, some low-level first-time stage sentence drug crimes. And the third area that the current statute allows to be sealed is juvenile certified as an adult. And so everything outside of those three areas under current law, because of the recent Supreme Court decision, is not, they're saying that because of the separation of powers arguments, that the court should not be sealed.
Thank you.
sentence for a petty misdemeanor, misdemeanor, or gross misdemeanor, and has not been convicted of a new crime for at least 5 years since discharge from sentence, or the petitioner was convicted of or received a stayed sentence for a felony violation of an offense listed in paragraph B and has not been convicted of a new crime for at least 8 years since discharge of the sentence. Those crimes that are enumerated in paragraph B are felonies that are on the first two, level one and two, on the sentencing guidelines grid, the lowest level of the sentencing guidelines grid, and that are not crimes of violence per the statute. But it also, it does allow some drug crimes that are in the crimes of violence statute to be sealed if they're on level one or two of the sentencing guidelines. Section 5 allows, with prosecutor agreement, for records to be administratively sealed by the court. The prosecutor has to notify the victim of this, and what essentially what that does is allows the record to be ordered sealed without the subject of the record having to follow current procedure, which is to file a petition, serve all the parties, arrive in court 2 months later, appear in court, wait 2 months. It's an expensive and complicated process. Under certain circumstances, this would alleviate the courts and others of that process with some guidelines. Section 6 amends the standard to some degree of when a court can grant these expungements. Under current law, the petitioner has the burden of proving by clear and convincing evidence that expungement would yield a benefit to the petitioner commensurate with the disadvantages to the public and public safety of sealing the record and burdening the court and other authorities. Something you should note is for the records that are added under the statute, even with the waiting periods, the petitioner still has to show by clear and convincing evidence that they are in need of the expungement and the benefits outweigh the disadvantages to the public and public safety. And then it also, this section also adds a list of factors that the court shall consider in granting an expungement, just provide some clarity for the court in things that the petitioner should, that the court shall consider in whether or not to grant an expungement in making that determination of the balancing test. The last section of section six, I'm sorry, provides civil liability protection for employers and landlords if they hire somebody who has already had a record expunged. What this does is it allows an expungement to be treated somewhat as, in addition to the sealing, some of you may have heard of the concept of a certificate of rehabilitation or certificate of restoration. It's a certificate somebody can get without sealing the record that would allow, that would protect landlords and employers from liability in hiring or housing the person. This language that is in here is really just transferred from a statute that was passed in 2009 that protects employers and landlords when they consider an expunged, or they consider somebody who has an expunged record, from that coming back and being the basis for a lawsuit. The language that Representative Moline just amended in there was an oversight that was left out from the existing statute that makes it essentially match that prior existing statute, except for the landlord addition here is an addition. Section 7 changes some of the limitations on statutory expungement. It actually increases some access to expunged records for law enforcement and prosecutors. Under current expungement law, if a law enforcement agency or a prosecutor requests somebody's background check from the BCA, they'll get a notice back. entities that received the order, and then it also requires those entities to send a letter to the petitioner confirming the record's been expunged. Sometimes attorneys in these cases have found that despite the expungement order, they'll find later that the record was never expunged, so this allows the petitioner to verify that those records were expunged. If they don't get the letter, they can follow up on it. And that is the walkthrough of the bill, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Housie. Questions from members? Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Housie, I have just a couple questions about the wording here. Section 2 of the bill on page 2, lines 2.16 to 2.18, I just want to make sure that there's a remedy here in case of violation. This says that the screening service shall promptly delete the record, or else what? Is there a cause of action here, as you interpret it, a civil cause of action, or is it just injunctive relief? Would they just get the benefit, for example, someone who's aggrieved, would they get the benefit of a court order ordering deletion of the record?
Mr. Housie.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I believe in section 332.70 there is a remedy. I don't recall what it is. Would it be possible to have House Research check on that, Mr. Chair?
House Research? Let's say again. Okay, can you repeat that question, Mr. Housie?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Representative Simon's question was for Section 2, the requiring a background screening service to delete expunged records, is there a remedy if they don't comply with that under Section 332.70 or Chapter 332?
Mr. Gary.
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, yes, there's a civil penalty in that section, and I think there's also a cause of action under federal law for certain types of violations. So,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a follow-up. I just wanted to make sure that there was a remedy. And then the second and final question I have is just on line 6.35. The solution here seems to be an evidentiary one, where it says information relating to criminal history, etc., may not be introduced as evidence in a civil action. And that's the sort of chosen fix here. Is there any possibility, though, that it could be used here? Is there any realistic possibility that there would be a criminal action of some kind against the landlord or against a business? And if so,
Mr. Hassan?
Would there be kind of an evidentiary loophole there? I'm just trying to figure out.
Mr. Chair and Representative Simon, I'm pretty familiar with the civil liability law for what's often called but it's been a long day. It's the liability that can ensue if an employer hires somebody with a past, violent past, and puts them in a position where they would have extra access to the public. Or customers, it's a pretty narrow area of liability. I'm not actually aware of any case law on this issue in the housing context, but we thought it would be nice to have that in there to give landlords who may be concerned about it some assurance. The question about whether there's criminal liability, I'm not aware of any there. I don't know if there could be some kind of a criminal negligence. I just have not seen it or heard of it.
Just checking. Thank you.
Any other questions for the bill's author or testifier? Seeing none, then any other, Representative Howe?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How did we come up with all these different criminal proceedings that they can get expunged? Is it that it came? I might have missed it. Did it come from exactly some place that it transferred into this bill?
Mr. Hossie.
Mr. Chair and Representative Howe, yes, you did miss it. Originally in an earlier draft, the bill had been worded so that
Public Affairs Committee.
Representative Howe? Good. You good, Representative Howe? Okay. Any other questions for just for Representative Scott?
Thanks. And I asked research about this, and maybe they can just clarify again because I'm just not getting this out of this language on unlawful detainers. So I guess we're on page 2, down towards the bottom, 2.31. It says the court may expunge the records relating to the action at the time judgment is entered or after that time. Is that only if the defendant prevails? I just want to get that on the record.
Mr. Housie.
Mr. Chair and Representative Scott, again, that's not my area of expertise. So I think you had asked House Research, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Ms. Mullen.
Chair and Representative Scott, the language there on line page 2, line 28, is that if the court or jury finds for the defendant,
okay, I didn't read it. Okay.
Yep, then the court can expunge a record relating to the action at the time the judgment's entered or after that. And so I think here it really would only be when the court or the jury has found for the defendant, and in an eviction that'll always be the tenant.
Yep. I just wanted to get that on the record.
Any other questions for the testifier witness? Any other members of the public who would like to testify on this bill other than Mr. Neumeister? Did I say that out loud? I'm just kidding, Mr. Neumeister. Please take a seat. Introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. I come with a background of being one of only maybe five or six people in 1996 when Representative Carruthers, this is one of his main bills that year, to do 609A. And so coming back how many years later, almost 18 years later, to where there's a great number of people who are getting together to do something with expungement, I think is great. And there have been a number of reasons why. But I do have some concerns about the bill that I would like to highlight to you, and as this goes through the process. First of all, I'd like to take a look at the Section 1, dealing with juveniles. One of the concerns I have is really what is the process that juveniles, 18, 19, maybe 20-year-old, who may have one offense, could be maybe a misdemeanor, a non-violent felony or whatever, what's the process that individual goes through? It's not too clear. I think under current law, to do it what they do under 609A is not the way to do it. And I want to make sure, you know, I think it's important to know how someone can easily get a juvenile record expunged. Number two, as you may know, based on policy that the legislature did in the year 1997, I think, or 98, it could have been earlier, it was a part of a broad agreement that basically juvenile records are destroyed at age 28 if you don't commit any offense between the age of 18 and 28. And I want to make sure that if the records are given out to other people, particularly juvenile records, and they do not commit any offense, that those records in those other agencies are also destroyed or expunged or whatever it may be. The third item is it's not too clear to me in the bill that when these records are shared with other parts of the executive branch, how they will handle them, particularly, again, on the juvenile record section. So I just share with you some of the because When one goes for an expungement through 609A or in general, in other processes historically here in Minnesota, the court has basically said, hey, you've done good, you're doing good, and all the standards or whatever it may happen. As part of that, we've also said...
Mr. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I can wait till he's finished.
Okay, Mr. Go ahead.
Okay. We also said is that we're not going to be releasing information without an independent review. Now, when the working group was a part of that process, there was a little bit of a discussion on that where Justice Anderson, formerly retired, and myself agreed to see that it's important to have an independent review why they're asking for the data. Now, currently, it's been my experience, my long time experience, that once information enters into an agency, it can be very much disseminated widely. So whether or not this person, you ask, hey, do you have any information? Do you have, give me the information you have on Rich Neumeister. Comes back, you have an expunged record from 19, whatever it might be, when I was a kid or as an adult. Now, that might be used for that investigation, but where I've seen historically with law enforcement agencies, they still retain the data, and sometimes that data is used for other purposes. LPR is one of them. In the LPR data, when agencies, before the big brouhaha over the last couple of years, they've been integrating it into some of their databases. St. Paul was doing this as early as 2010. The other thing is, like with cell phone data, what's been happening across the country when they do tower dumps of innocent people, because law enforcement is interested to see patterns and associations, they'll still keep the information on the on innocent folks. And I've seen it in other situations here. So that's one of the concerns that I have, because as you know, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, law enforcement, particularly sheriffs and police, do a lot of background checks, do a lot of investigations. And one of the things, whether it be on the Kerry Casanon bill, that some of you are familiar with landlords, all of a sudden is this going to end up? Or even in gun background checks, permit to buy, or whatever. And so, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I don't see, other than I was told, when I saw this piece, I went to a member of the association, and what I was told was part of the grand deal. Well, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I've learned over the years, grand deals are not. The public can still put their 2 cents in and let legislators know so that you can decide, because it's not the folks in the back hallways under a grand deal, from my point of view, Mr. Chairman. They could come up and help you, you know, when you don't have time or whatever, but you still put your stamp and your vote on whether or not you want that policy to go forward or not. So, Mr. Chairman, those are my perspectives on those 2 points, and I wish to thank you very much for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any questions? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Members, I just wanted to make it known why it is that law enforcement and sentencing guidelines and prosecutors need to have access to some of these expunged records without a warrant. In this bill, there are actually going to be records expunged that for 15 years after the person was discharged from probation, you still can use it for criminal history points. So if they commit a crime in the future, you would use that criminal history point to determine whether or not they should go to prison or not. If you expunge the record prior, so if they're on probation for 5 years, and then you can use the record for 15 years after, that is eligible for use in criminal history score points for 20 years. We don't want to make it so that no one can have a record expunged in 20 years just because you might have someone who commits a crime within that 20-year period and not be able to use that record for sentencing. The second reason is many of those offenses that are eligible for expungement and
broader iteration of the well decisions of the board.
in order to make sure they get the proper sentence and proper charge.
Thank you, Representative Hellstrom. Mr. Neumeister.
Yes, one of the things what you're expunging here is not just convictions, but you're also probably, could possibly be expunging arrest type records, which are not to connect to conviction. So I think that's important. Again, information in an agency can do things and also give impressions. Now, Mr. Chairman, my last comment is that we've lived under the law for 18 years, 19 years, with the ex parte. If you're going to go in that direction, which this bill proposes, I would like to suggest that you beef up the accountability in that section. The word pertinent is a word that I've, the pertinent in initiating, furthering, or completing an investigation, I've seen for decades, because it's a nice choice of words to use that's been in 1382 for a number of years. And something like this, I'd like to see at least some type of higher standard or some type of accountability or some aspect to that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Chairman.
And thank you.
Are there any other members of the public who wish to be heard on House File 2576 as amended? Please come down, identify yourself for the record, and begin your testimony.
Good evening. Thank you. My name is Andrea Palumbo, and I'm a private attorney in St. Paul, and I am very pleased to speak in favor of this bill. The majority of my practice is criminal record expungements. I would say 90% of the work I do is in that area. And I work with individuals who are preparing their own petitions and getting ready to represent themselves because they can't afford a lawyer. And I'm also a volunteer attorney with the Volunteer Lawyers Network. So I've seen different kinds of situations where people are seeking expungements. This bill will really help a lot of people. Right now, the law, when I talk to people who want to have a record expunged, I really have to give them a long explanation about how, as the law stands right now, they really won't get a full remedy. Best case scenario, if they had made a guilty plea in their case, which most people have, the majority of cases that move through the criminal justice system end up resolved with some kind of a plea agreement, that the best they could hope for is to have the judicial branch records sealed. The executive branch records connected to their crime, the BCA records, police records, in most cases those cannot be sealed. And inevitably then they ask me, well, what's the point? And and that's really a tough question to ask. It really doesn't give them a meaningful remedy. And I've also seen in my court appearances that judges are frustrated with the state of the law, too. They're frustrated that they can't give a meaningful remedy to people who are seeking it, and that they really can't give them something that will help them. I really think that judges have been frustrated by that. My clients that I'm working with are not career criminals. They're not people who have just decided, okay, my sentence is done, I want to get this expunged. There are people who are finding out years after they've completed their sentence that they're trying to move forward, they're trying to get housing, they're in graduate school for a licensed profession, and they're finding out that all of the work that they've done might be for nothing because they can't get a clean background check. And it's something that people are honestly thinking that this is something that was in their past. They completed their sentence, they paid their fines, they went through probation, they thought they were done, and now it's coming up and standing in their way. The majority of my clients, been really recently interpreted to mean that you can never seal executive branch records. We have had that happen in the past. A lot of executive branch records were sealed. This law will go really help clarify the situation, and the waiting periods that are mentioned in the bill after a sentence is completed are absolutely reasonable. In many cases, that's when people are coming to me 3 years, 5 years after they've completed their sentence, looking to have this done. So overall, this is a very reasonable bill, and it's really going to help a lot of individuals. It'll help practitioners. We'll be able to tell potential clients what their situation is. It will allow judges to provide meaningful remedies, and it'll really help a lot of people who are seeking to move forward with their life. They'll be able to make a good, reasoned decision on whether or not to seek an expungement. So thank you again for your time, and as I said, I am very much in favor of this bill.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Palumbo. Are there any questions for testifier?
Thank you. Not for Ms. Palumbo, but thank you for your testimony.
Oh, thank you.
I'm sorry, are there other testifiers, or are there?
Well, there may be other members of the public who want to testify. Mr. Kingray, anyone else plan on coming down? Okay, it's just you, Mr. Kingray. So,
I can wait.
Okay. Kingray, come on down. Thank you, Ms. Palumbo.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is John Kingry, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. I'll be very brief. I know the hour is late and you have many days and weeks ahead of you. We have worked for or against this issue since at least 2005. And we came very close in 2010 with a much more limited expungement bill, which is in this bill. It failed in the last few weeks of session, again, because of this concern that records would be misused. And it's regrettable that that did not pass. This year is a much more comprehensive bill. It is one in which I do want to express my appreciation to both the House and Senate authors. One of the things that this does is it undoes us two Supreme Court decisions last year, which seals executive branch records. It's kind of a philosophical gulf that we had to bridge, but we did it. And again, we feel that it's important that the criminal justice community has the ability to have access and to use those records. If there are any questions related to this, Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Tammy McConkie is here and would be happy to answer any questions that you have. At this point, I can only say that we support the concept. I believe by a week from Friday, I can finally get up and say to whoever that we endorse this bill. I fully expect that to happen. With that, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd be happy to answer any questions. Again, I do have Assistant Ramsey County Attorney Tammy McConkie, who did testify previously at another hearing.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Kingry. Any questions for Mr. Kingry? Seeing none, then thank you. Representative Sion?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just had a question either for the author or Mr. Hazy about, you know, we've just been handed, and I know you're familiar with these arguments, but we've all just been handed a letter from Liz Richards of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women, and I just wanted, since this is the Civil Law Committee, just invite you to comment, not so much on line by line of the letter, but the sum and substance seems to be a concern about the inability to use these for certain civil purposes as opposed to criminal. I know this is going to public safety next, but this being the Civil Law Committee, just could you comment on the letter's expressed concern that records would not be available in high-stakes civil proceedings like divorce, custody, OFP, even administrative hearings having to do with immigration, disability, tax relief, etc. Just wanted to invite you to address those arguments.
Are not completely out of line.
years for the felony offense. I think, you know, if I remember offhand for things like OFPs and harassment restraining orders, the incident had to have taken place within 2 years prior to seeking those sorts of orders, so I'm not sure they would have been able to use the record anyways. But when it comes to the custody proceedings and a couple of other concerns that the group cited, I think we still need to work on those going forward and before the next hearing so we can try to address those concerns.
Mr.
Chair, as long as the Minnesota Coalition is here, I'm wondering if it'd be okay if someone from the coalition testifies to the civil components of the bill. I passed out the letter.
Ms. Richards, if you would, please introduce yourself for the record. Thank you for coming down, and if you could address Representative Paymars.
Thank you, Chairman Lesh, members of the committee. I'm Liz Richards. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Coalition for Battered Women. And what I would agree that we are working, I think our letter expresses some of our concerns, that we are thinking through what's the impact that expungement of these records may have, particularly outside of the criminal arena, in terms of other legal processes where documentation of criminal activity or criminal convictions are currently being used or are needed in those other legal proceedings, and trying to figure out ways to make sure that those concerns can get addressed and still be able to give people meaningful relief through the expungement. So I think that we may be able to reach agreement, hopefully, before we get to the next committee. But and we're in dialogue and talking about those things, and this kind of lays out some of the issues in the categories. We just haven't been able to come up with language that doesn't create more problems and that does address these. So that's kind of where we're at. I don't know if the people have questions for us.
I don't think so. I think your remarks are well taken, Ms. Richards, and my impression is that some progress will be made about other issues relating to the bill to be here in the next committee. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I just want to say thank you to the coalition. Members, originally the targeted misdemeanors, so any domestic assault, stalking, any of those crimes were not eligible to be expunged at all. And it was actually Ms. Palumbo, I believe, who brought a victim who had, as part of a plea agreement, had pled guilty to a crime. And so it was because sometimes victims actually end up being charged and convicted of crimes that we even started talking about whether or not these kinds of offenses should be expunged at all. So they didn't come late to the game. It's just those records were not going to be eligible to be expunged at all. And I think that if there isn't some kind of agreement that's reached, we'll probably go back to that kind of a situation where some of those records just won't be eligible.
Thank you, Representative Hillstrom. Any other questions for Ms. Richards? Thank you, Ms. Richards, for coming down and testifying. Any other questions for the author? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a question for Mr. Kingery, if you want to come back up to the testifiers table. Just wondered if you could discuss and point out in the current version of this bill where your issues are with sealing records in the executive branch. We're having some discussions here, and we're just not quite sure where that is in the bill.
Mr. Kingery?
That you're addressing.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Scott, it's in the juvenile section, which is in section one, I believe, and I'm just going to guess based on memory. It's
Thank you.
Mr. Neumeister brought up, I'm sorry, about the one section on page 7, I believe it is. That whole paragraph 1, number 1 there, just if you would, you know, be willing to work on that section to tighten up that language, the pertinent in initiating, furthering, and completing of an investigation. I think that is a troublesome area that needs to probably be polished up just a little bit. So just wanted to get your reaction to see if you'd be willing to work on that section as well.
Similarly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Scott. I think that's one of the sections we're going to be working on before the next committee stop. We've heard similar concerns in our last committee stop as well, as far as the, you know, ex parte order and what's current law and what the new law is and what the definition of pertinent might be. And so, you know, I share your concerns, and I'm certainly willing to work on that section. I did, in Judiciary Committee, I added the 7.33 and 7.34 to make sure that this language, where you no longer need an ex parte court order, only applies to expunged records after the effective date. What I was trying to get at is people who have expungements right now, they have those, that protection in place where the ex parte order is required, and I wanted to make sure we weren't taking that protection away from people that already have an expunged record. But now we're running into the issue of, you know, is this workable through the BCA and some other agencies that actually handle these records? So, yes, we continue to work on that section before the next committee hearing.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the author? Seeing none, then, well, the chair renews the motion that House File 2256 as amended, be referred to Public Safety, Finance, and Policy Committee. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say no. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Representative Moline.
Thank you, members.
Members, our next meeting will be Friday, March 14th at 10 a.m. We will take a one-hour break for lunch from noon to 1 and proceed, I'm guessing, another 2 hours, depending on how it goes. That was the preference of the committee, that we're not going to be working straight through until we take a lunch break. So with that, there being no other business before committee is adjourned.